Welcome to the Kings and Queens podcast with your host, Johnny Langton. His temper was warm and impetuous, but he was good-natured and sincere. He was unskilled in the royal talent of dissimulation. He always was what he appeared to be. He might offend, but he never deceived. What you saw was what you got. Could Britain's second Hanoverian king provide calm composure against the immense challenges presented by a new Jacobite claimant, and the first true global conflict in an unforgiving environment led by burgeoning prime ministers? This is George II. George was born on the 10th of November, 1683, in Hanover. He was the eldest child of first cousins George, the hereditary prince of Braunschweig-Lüneburg, and Sophia Dorothea of Celle. His mother tongue was French, and only learnt German at the age of four. He later learned English and Italian, and studied genealogy and history. However, in the fields of diplomacy and military tactics was where he developed his true, lifelong passions. His childhood was rocked due to his parents' utterly loveless and acrimonious marriage. They were both adulterous. While his father George had numerous traditional mistresses, it was his mother's relationship with Swedish Count Hans Philip Christoph von Königsmark which embroiled the couple in public scandal. Young George's grandfather, the newly appointed Prince-Elector of Hanover, Ernest Augustus, intercepted love letters between the couple and used them to orchestrate the murder of the Swedish Count. Soon afterwards, George's parents were divorced, and his mother was imprisoned at Arden Castle, where she remained for the rest of her life. Young George was just 9 years old and was refused all access to his mother. The young George's relationship with his father would never recover. It wasn't until decades later, when the young George was crowned, did he discover those very love letters, and he realised that his mother had been an adulterer. Despite the rancorous relationship between father and son, the eldest George, now Elector of Hanover, was keen for his son to marry for love. He allowed his son to choose his own wife. This was rare among royal circles. Traditionally, their father would arrange marriages to suit diplomatic needs. Perhaps the elder George did not want his son to experience the same marital turmoil he had been through. The young George visited the court of Ansbach, incognito, in order to meet Caroline. He was taken aback and was smitten. In August 1705, George married Caroline in the chapel of Herrenhausen in Hanover. Without a mother figure, Caroline would have a considerable and sustained influence over George. She was described as large and blonde, with a beautiful smile, and having a bosom of exemplary magnitude. She was also described as being perhaps the most intelligent of all queen consorts. By the turn of the century, the young George was keen to put his military tactical knowledge to action, and he looked to the War of the Spanish Succession for his theatre. His father refused until the young George himself had an heir, thus safeguarding their line. In 1707, Caroline gave birth to a son, Frederick. Many more children would follow, six of whom survived to adulthood. In 1708, the 24-year-old George fought at the major battle of Oudenarde, commanded by John Churchill, the Duke of Marlborough. It pitched the Grand Alliance, including Britain and Hanover, against France. He charged in the vanguard of a Hanoverian cavalry. Marlborough later described George as having distinguished himself extremely, charging at the head of and animating by his example the Hanoverian troops, who played a good part in this happy victory. In 1714, Queen Anne of Great Britain died. Due to their Protestantism, the line of succession had passed to young George's grandmother, Sophia of Hanover, a granddaughter of James VI and I. She died just a few weeks before Anne, which meant young George's father became George I of Great Britain. The young George was heir to the throne. In September, young George arrived in a formal procession and was granted the traditional title for the heir to the throne, the Prince of Wales. Britain was a total culture shock. Hanover was small, relatively tranquil, and easy to govern. Britain was populous and constitutionally charged. When George was in Hanover, he would traverse peaceful, verdant hills. When he entered London, he was struck with a barrage of urban cacophony. Young George's life as Prince of Wales was marred by his deteriorating relationship with his father, the King. While both Georges suffered from a culture shock, the young George was able to acclimatise more naturally. His fluency in English was a huge advantage, and his vivacity drew more warmth from the population. It was a point of deep contempt. When King George visited Hanover in July 1716, he gave the prince the largely powerless title of lieutenant instead of the position of regent, which would have allowed the prince to deputise. The prince responded by touring the country, garnering support. An attempt on his life at a theatre on Drury Lane did even more to increase his public profile. Father and son fell out entirely during a dispute over who should become the godfather of George's infant son. It led to the prince and princess's banishment from a royal palace. The king also took custody of their children. The prince formed a new rival political faction based at Leicester House, which would take in disgruntled politicians, unhappy with the governing Whigs or the king. Robert Walpole became the bedrock for opposition to the king. Leicester House was a royal court in waiting. The king couldn't compete with the bright, vibrant court. His personality simply didn't match. He also failed to ignite the public's imagination due to his limited English. The prince would pander often shamelessly to the public. He once proclaimed, fluently yet heavily accented, "I have not one drop of blood that is not English." In 1720, the pair half-heartedly reconciled on the insistence of Walpole for the sake of public unity. Walpole was embarking on a monumental political rise and rejoined the ranks of the king. The prince saw this as a betrayal. After the reconciliation, the relationship was characterised not by a media-frenzied PR war, but one of mutual coldness. The prince and princess of Wales retired to obscurity, agreeing not to show up the king, nor divert attention. However, privately, the pair still didn't speak. Their children were still in the royal palace, and the prince was still just a lieutenant when the king was abroad. In June 1727, King George I died en route to Hanover, just 6 months after his ex-wife, who had spent 32 years confined to Arden Castle. Back in England, Robert Walpole is told the news of the king's death during dinner. He immediately leaves the table, races to the stables, and rides to young George, determined to be the first to tell him. He has to wake the prince, who doesn't believe him. Due to Walpole being back in the king's favour, the prince was highly suspicious of Walpole, and initially thought it was a trick in order to push the prince into treason. However, it soon became clear that his father was indeed dead. Even in death, there was no love lost. The prince's refusal to attend his father's funeral in Hanover was seen as an expression of loyalty to Great Britain, and he won further plaudits. He then suppressed his father's will. It is believed the old king's will attempted to split Hanover and Britain between his grandsons. The prince disposed of it, and a sole ruler would endure. When news of the king's death spread throughout Europe, James Stuart, the chief Jacobite claimant, anticipating an uprising, raced from Bologna to the English Channel, by which time he expected to meet a swollen force of Jacobites. He was, however, refused assistance, and he stormed back to Italy. The French were right in their assessment. They required support, within the political ranks in Britain, where there was significant Tory scheming upon the accession of George I. This time, Tories were paying respect to the new George. The succession would pass without disturbance. On the 11th of October, George and Caroline were crowned King and Queen of Great Britain in one of the greatest coronations in the nation's history. The procession through the streets was so long, it took 2 hours to pass by. Scaffolds were constructed inside Westminster Abbey for people to come and watch the ceremony. George Frederick Handel was tasked with composing 4 anthems in just 4 weeks. Despite his father being Handel's patron, the new king recognised the composer's importance. He wrote, "The king shall rejoice. My heart is inditing, and let thy hand be strengthened." His most famous piece, however, was Zadok the Priest, an anthem which has been played in all subsequent coronations. Perhaps the most nervous man in the government during the succession was also the government's most powerful man, the Prime Minister Robert Walpole. After Walpole had re-entered government under his father, the younger George had become distrustful of Walpole. George called him a great rogue. He called Walpole's ally and foreign policy chief Townsend a choleric blockhead. While royal power had been substantially reduced, George as king retained the ability to appoint and dismiss government ministers, and it was widely assumed both would be dismissed and replaced with Spencer Compton. However, he garnered little respect from his peers, described as a plodding, heavy fellow with great application, but no talent. In contrast, Walpole led the way in British policymaking. He continued to keep Britain secure and out of foreign wars. He had a substantial majority. To dismiss Walpole would create instability and upheaval, not what George would want, particularly early in his reign. To secure George's confidence, Walpole granted him an extremely generous income of £800,000 per annum. In today's money, it is an eye-watering £100 million. Only Walpole could have possibly secured such an income for the king. George had debt from his time as Prince of Wales. He was also known for avarice and meanness. The income was particularly pleasing for the king. However, perhaps the most important factor in Walpole's survival was his friendship with the new queen. Caroline helped mould the king's mind and convinced him to retain the prime minister. Within 2 weeks, Walpole was secure in his position, and their relationship grew stronger. Caroline would meet Walpole secretly before his audience with the king. Walpole commented, "The queen could make him propose the very thing as his, which a week before he had rejected as mine. The raw relationship to power. You may strut, dapper George, but 'twill all be in vain. We all know 'tis Queen Caroline, not you, that reign." When Townsend resigned his position in 1730, Walpole took control of foreign affairs. It was perhaps this moment that the true role of a prime minister took shape. In 1733, Walpole moved in to 10 Downing Street. The new king was determined to rule, not as a reluctant German, but as a British king. Contemporaries noted his willingness to throw himself into the business of government, to not be passive nor submissive. He insisted on being informed of everything and worked extremely hard, even to the detriment of his health. He wanted to sit on the boards of the Treasury, the Admiralty and the War Office. He was particularly keen on foreign policy and wanted to control as much as possible. He would regularly read dispatches and was particularly adamant in controlling military patronage. His keen interest in all military matters meant he kept a close eye on military developments abroad He carried a map of Crimea with him to record regular updates on the Russian campaign in 1736. Much like his father, his main grievance was in his homeland of Hanover. While he insisted on ruling as a British king, by the end of his reign he was visiting Hanover as often as his father. While his interference in foreign affairs caused a nuisance for ministers, and though he still refused to appoint ministers he didn't like, his lack of agenda domestically meant the country continued to stabilise. There he fell into an honorary role and closely followed the advice of Walpole and others who made the key decisions. Following George's succession, his eldest son Frederick arrived on British shores to take the title of Prince of Wales. He had been left in Hanover by his parents as a young child and hadn't seen them for 14 years. Frederick's relationship with his parents was perhaps even more hostile and bitter than that of George and his father. Before Frederick had even arrived in Britain, his father had intervened to prevent Frederick from marrying a Prussian princess on the grounds of her apparent dubious mental stability. At every turn, Frederick and his parents deposed each other. George and Frederick were obstructed and frustrated by their respective fathers' refusal to increase their incomes or allow them any responsibility in running the country. The prince declared himself in opposition to the king and his ministers, severed all links with the king's court, and ordered those of their household servants with seats in Parliament to vote against ministerial measures. Frederick attempted to exert pressure on the king in order to gain concessions. It was from the same building that George himself had set up his rival political faction where Frederick built his base, Leicester House. The king and queen detested their son. Caroline once said, "I wish the ground would open up this moment and sink the monster to the lowest hole of hell." When the government passed the Gin Act in 1736, a tax hike for gin in an attempt to curb consumption due to growing social problems, Frederick responded by advertising his presence in tavern, raising the glass in defiance of the new act. When the king hit a storm returning to Britain in January 1737, rumours he had drowned spread across the kingdom. When he did return safely, he caught a fever. Frederick spread the rumours that his father was dying. George was forced to attend an event in order to disprove the gossip. In July, Frederick excluded his parents from the birth of his daughter by driving his pregnant wife off in the middle of the night in secret. It was against royal protocol, and the king and queen were furious. In a moment of déjà vu, George banished his son from court, though he did not take away his children, as his father had done to him. The king was known for his temper. He would regularly throw strops if things went exactly how he wanted them, such as the tidiness of his wigs or the position of his furniture. He had no interest in reading or writing, meaning he had a very short paper trail. He would only scribble notes on ministers' documents during meetings. His interests, aside from military pursuits, included stag hunting, riding, and playing cards. He had little interest in the arts or science, though he did issue the charter for King's College, New York, later becoming Columbia University, and he lent his name to the colony and later US state of Georgia in 1732. What is known about George, and what he did share in common with his father, was his keeping of multiple mistresses. First was Mary Bellenden. She found the affair both passionless and unrewarding. George reportedly ogled her at a ball, and was seen counting his gold in his purse, as if he was about to buy her services. Another was the plump and dowdy Henrietta Howard, George's mistress since his time as Prince of Wales. She became a woman of the bedchamber in exchange for a trifle £2,000 per year. She was poor and lowly, yet she remained in the royal house for 20 years. George, known for his precision and attention to detail, would enter headquarters at precisely 7 p.m. If he was even a minute or two early, he would wait outside. When George was losing interest in Howard, it was the Queen who insisted on George keeping her. Why? Howard was obedient, virtuous and innocent. It was much safer for George, who had a tendency to be swayed, to have a mistress who was entirely unthreatening to the status quo. They had no power. Walpole knew this, and wasted no time in courting George's mistresses, like his peers did. Instead, only courting the Queen. Yet, it may have affected his reputation somewhat. In May 1736, during a trip to Hanover with his chief mistress, Amalia van Valmolden, a note was left on the gates of St. James's Palace. Lost or strayed out of this house, a man who has left a wife and 6 children on the parish. The parish meaning poor relief. George saw his mistresses in a rather untraditional way. According to the Queen's favourite, Lord Hervey, the King was incapable of being attached to any other woman, and he seemed to look upon his mistresses as a necessary appurtenance to his grandeur as a prince, rather than an addition to his pleasure. In 1736, Caroline became gravely ill. An umbilical rupture had been left untreated, and her bowel had now been squeezed out. Doctors believed it to be an abscess, and they cut off her protruding bowel. It led to a slow and painful death. George displayed a tenderness of which previously was thought he was incapable. On the 20th of November 1737, the Queen died. In her dying days, she had implored George to remarry. He responded, "No, I shall have mistresses." He cried, "I never met a woman worthy to buckle her shoe." He had all the Queen's removed from his playing cards and continued to pay her staff. George would now rule alone. Despite the death of his greatest advocate, Robert Walpole remained in position. George had grown to admire and respect Walpole, yet events in the 1730s had brought Britain into conflict, at odds with Walpole's peaceful philosophy, resulting in the gradual decline of Walpole's premiership. George was keen to engage in war due to his own military background and enthusiasm. Britain would be handed an excuse. When British Sea Captain Robert Jenkins returned home, with one ear ostensibly cut off by Spanish coast guards who had boarded his ship, the country took notice. He willfully displayed his pickled ear in a jar for all to see. When he presented his ear in the chamber of the House of Commons, it became a symbol of national pride, catching the country's imagination. Among those demanding war was the young, zealous MP, William Pitt. The Spanish now must be taught a lesson. The event precipitated war, aptly named the War of Jenkins' Ear. In truth, the war was largely due to a failed settlement from a previous year and a much more significant standoff over trading ambitions in the Caribbean. The Prime Minister could not control a belligerent nation. He proclaimed bitterly, "They now ring their bells, but they will soon wring their hands." By 1742, the conflict was incorporated into a much larger war that had embroiled almost all of the European powers, the War of the Austrian Succession. This was a dispute over Mary Theresa's right to succeed to the Austrian throne, the British support of the Austrians against the French. It also coincided with King George's War, the name given to military operations against the French in North America. None of these wars led to significant gains or losses for Britain. An enthusiastic King George led British and Hanoverian troops against the French at the Battle of Dettingen on the 27th of June 1743. At the extraordinary age of 59, the king charged into battle. At one point his horse bolted backwards, forcing him to dismount. Trusting his feet more, he charged on foot. His stories of conflict he would later retell with great detail to anyone who would listen. To his delight, it was an Allied victory. He handed out numerous promotions, and the victory was later celebrated with a new piece of music, Dettingen Te Deum, performed by Handel. However, back home, George was criticised for wearing the pale blue colours of Hanover. It drew a personal attack upon the king by William Pitt, calling the victory a one-off in an otherwise muddled conflict. Pitt was correct. The campaign suffered from serious differences of opinion, bad weather and disease, meaning little impact could be seen on France's eastern frontier. Nevertheless, Dettingen was the very last time a British monarch led troops into battle. During the 1741 general election campaign, the ageing Robert Walpole was under significant pressure. Despite George's efforts to bribe his son Frederick, he continued to campaign for the opposition. Walpole secured only a very slim majority, and many constituencies returned MPs loyal to Frederick and hostile to the Prime Minister, meaning his true majority was difficult to determine. His support was waning. The following year, Walpole faced the very first de facto no-confidence vote, which he lost. After 20 years, Walpole resigned from the government. For the man he had once called a rogue, the king wept. He was replaced briefly by Spencer Compton until his death. He was followed by Henry Pelham, a man described as having all talents for obtaining power, but not for implementing it. Pelham was pro-peace and had been pro-Walpole. Pro-war MPs such as Pitt simmered on the backbenches. While Henry Pelham's tenure saw a largely uneventful domestic period and a lethargic approach to war overseas, an old enemy reared its head once more. On the 19th of August, a young, determined and courageous Jacobite called Bonnie Prince Charlie raised the royal standard at Glenfinnan in the Highlands of Scotland. He had landed with just 7 companions, but quickly mustered an army of Highlanders. They had been alarmed by Charlie's lack of men, but he persuaded them that the French support would arrive imminently once evidence of their success was clear. However, the French saw this merely as another front in the war of the Austrian succession, providing only subsidies. The army of 1,200 men marched south, capturing Perth and Edinburgh. They then entered England, taking Carlisle, Penrith, Lancaster, Preston, and Manchester. The Jacobites continued to outmaneuver the English, commanded by the Duke of Cumberland, King George's youngest son, who was struggling with a skeleton army. On the 4th of December, the Jacobites reached Derby, just over 100 miles from the poorly defended London. Their force was now 5,000. Charlie was poised to strike. However, the Highlanders had run out of patience. They had expected French support. It didn't come. They had expected the English to rise up. They instead were met with indifference. Again, a Jacobite had miscalculated the national mood. George himself had not panicked upon hearing of the Jacobite insurgents. The Hanoverians were now explicitly accepted by the vast majority of the population. Perhaps Charlie had the forces to take London, however it would most likely have been temporary. With British forces en route from the continent, Charlie and the Highlanders marched back to Scotland. The English followed them. Charlie developed a reputation for viciousness and violence, and was said to be drinking a bottle of brandy per day. In April 1746, Cumberland's army had been reinforced, and was celebrating the prince's birthday. Charlie and the Jacobites decided to try and catch the English off guard. Yet, they took so long to find them in the dead of night that they gave up before dawn. The next day, a well-rested English force pitched up against a beleaguered, bleary-eyed Jacobite force at the Battle of Culloden, the last pitched battle in British history. The outnumbered Highlanders fought like wildcats, but were overwhelmed. The Jacobites were massacred, and were emphatically defeated. Their cause was now dead. When Charlie refused to charge during the battle, and instead fled the field, he was called a damned Italian coward and a scoundrel by his own bodyguard. A £30,000 bounty was placed on Charlie's head. He was harboured by loyalist Flora MacDonald on the Isle of Skye. In true Stuart style, he dressed up as her spinning maid. At one point, when the pair were confronted by guards, Flora distracted them by performing a Highland dance, allowing her maid to slip away. Centuries later, Charlie's journey was recalled in a famous Scottish song. Speed, bonny boat, like a bird on a wing. Onwards, the sailors cry. Carry the lad that's born to be king, over the sea to Skye. Charlie escaped and lived out his days in Rome. He would be portrayed for centuries as a romantic figure failure. The long-term effects of the final Jacobite uprising were deep. Cumberland, nicknamed the Butcher, ordered men to treat all injured Jacobite men with their bayonets. Clandam was eviscerated, their local rights were taken, tartan was banned, and leaders were executed or imprisoned. Scotland reacted by throwing themselves into the Union, and Tories who were traditionally sympathetic to the Jacobite cause were unshackled, an important step in becoming a serious political threat to the Whigs. The ruthless response proved that alarm bells truly rang within the British establishment, even if George had remained calm and collected. In George's eyes, the true threat came from his own Parliament, William Pitt. He was becoming difficult to ignore. The Commons purred to the eloquent orations of Pitt, yet George openly declared that he did not like him and would not do his business. Pitt had made a name for himself, not least in his open criticisms of the King. After Dettingen, Pitt mocked George. His Majesty was exposed to few or no dangers abroad, such as the overturning of a coach or the stumbling of his horse. While Pitt was banished from power, he remained in Parliament, as he was seen as too dangerous not to be. Eventually, in 1746, Pitt was appointed Paymaster General, with George under intense pressure to do so. Samuel Johnson later quipped, "Where Walpole was a minister given by the King to his people, Pitt was a minister given by the people to the King." Pitt then cooled in his vitriol. "I have, upon some former occasions by the heat of youth and the warmth of debate, been hurried into expressions which upon cool reflection I have heartily regretted." Despite some limited concessions on both sides, Pitt was still nowhere near the post of Prime Minister. Pitt and the King were not about to enjoy a close, trusting relationship. In 1751, Frederick died suddenly, perhaps from pleurisy. With Frederick's children young, there was a fear that if George II died soon, Cumberland would be a dastardly regent in the mould of Richard III, with Pitt suggesting that he would be less interested in protecting the crown than wearing it. In 1756, Britain became involved in what many historians believe was the first true global conflict, the Seven Years' War. It was centred around the rise of Prussia as a prominent force in Europe. Prussian expansion threatened France, Russia, Austria and Spain. With the British concerned over French expansion into Hanover, they allied with Prussia and their king, Frederick the Great. War quickly spread to the colonies. In the same year, Menorca, a British colony at the time, was invaded by the French. Admiral John Byng was sent to relieve the garrison. but he was poorly equipped and he failed. Upon his return, he was court-martialed for failing to do his utmost to protect Menorca and was executed by firing squad. This was seen by many as a smokescreen to protect the Prime Minister, Thomas Pelham, the brother of his predecessor Henry. Pelham was temporarily replaced. In the same year, the Indian Nawab, allied with the French, captured Calcutta, imprisoning and suffocating 123 men in a basement, later dubbed the Black Hole of Calcutta. The number was perhaps exaggerated for propaganda purposes. Meanwhile, in North America, the French were expanding from Canada down to Mississippi, threatening to encircle the 13 British colonies in the east. The following year, in 1757, in the ultimate humiliation, Cumberland was defeated in Hanover, and George's homeland was conquered by the French. The British had made a stuttering, damaging start to the Seven Years' War. It was time for Pitt. He proclaimed, "I know I can save this country, and no one else can." Pitt, though not made Prime Minister, was now able to implement his global policy. It was perhaps the first time overwhelming public support had prevailed over fickle royal patronage. In early 1757, General Robert Clive was dispatched to retake Calcutta. In June the same year at the Battle of Plassey, Clive defeated the Nawab of Bengal and his French allies. The British East India Company were able to establish control of Bengal, and over the next 100 years, seized control of most of the Indian subcontinent, laying the foundation for the British East India Company. British fortunes continued to change as Hanover was retaken for the Allies by Ferdinand of Braunschweig-Wolfenbüttel in 1758. In 1759, decisive naval victories against the French prevented their invasion of Britain, but it was in North America where Pitt's true legacy was written. In 1758, the British had moved into the Ohio Valley to push the French westwards. The British captured the fort of Duquesne, it was renamed Pittsburgh, in Pitt's honour. Then, the British moved northwards, up the St. Lawrence River. Using the expertise of a young map reader called Captain James Cook, they sneaked up the apparently impregnable hilltop fort of Quebec in the dead of night. There, they ambushed the French. The British commander, James Wolfe, was shot twice in the chest. He gave his final orders mid-battle before turning over to die in peace. His counterpart was also mortally injured. Wolfe would be later given a state funeral at Westminster Abbey. Quebec was captured by the British. The following year, Montreal was taken. Further south, the French had been all but driven from the modern-day United States. 1759 would become known as Annus Mirabilis, the wonderful year. It saw Britain under Pitt's command reach its zenith of global power. Horace Walpole said, "Our bells are worn threadbare, ringing for victories." It is the final Britain that the aged king would see. By October 1760, George was blind in one eye and hard of hearing, though he remained in good health, and contemporaries had commented on how well he looked for his age. At 76, he was at this point the longest lived monarch in British history. On the 25th of October, at 6 a.m, the king woke up. He drank some hot chocolate, went to the toilet. It was from there that his courtier heard a huge crash. He entered to find the king on the floor. He was taken to bed, and there he died. He had suffered from an aortic dissection. He had died without a day's warning. He left instructions for the sides of his coffin and his wife's coffin to be removed allowing their remains to mingle. He became the last British monarch to be buried at Westminster Abbey. By some contemporaries, he was described as ineffective, weak, a buffoon. Yet a considerable number of tributes upon his death suggest he was admired. Thomas Pelham said he was the best master and the best friend a subject could have. Under George, the country was not subject to rapaciousness, nor the insolence of favourites. This was rare indeed. George took to the role of a largely ceremonial monarch. He allowed the most talented politicians to rule, albeit occasionally with some resistance. His steadiness and character rewarded Britain in unsettled times, and while his input was limited, under his reign, Britain extinguished the threat of another revolution. It saw monumental military victories, and she became the true global leader, contributing massively to the growth of the British Empire. According to Elizabeth Montagu, his character would not afford to epic poetry, but will look well in the sown pages of history. Thank you for listening. Join us next time for our third Georgian, George III. If you would like to send a question in, you can contact us on email, thekingsandqueenspodcast@gmail.com. We're on Twitter, Kings Queens Pod, Instagram, Kings Queens Podcast, and on Facebook, The Kings and Queens Podcast. Send your comments in, send your questions in, and I will see you next time.